Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Aha, feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Nikias, well, Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, it's time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up as we record early on a Thursday afternoon. So we haven't had the two-game NBA slate or the Sweet 16 action on the men's side. So we will see how that goes a little bit later. But hope you're doing well. Hope everyone's doing well. Let's dig into some news. We have some fun mailbag questions coming at you later in the show. So thank you to those who sent in questions. Again, if you have basketball thoughts, basketball questions at any time, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Let's start with some news on the W side or on the women's basketball side overall. The 2024 USA Women's National Team camp roster has been announced. We got 14 players. We had one camp in February. We got another one now in Cleveland, I think April 3rd through April 5th. But the players that have been listed on the roster, we have Chelsea Gray, Kelsey Plum, Jewel Lloyd, Sabrina Ionescu, Caitlin Clark making the training camp roster this time around. Jackie Young, Ryan Howard, Ariel Atkins, Diana Taurasi, Brianna Stewart, Asia Wilson, Brittany Griner, Aaliyah Boston, and Shakira Austin. Some notable names not listed of this time around who were at the February camp includes Alyssa Thomas, Nafisa Collier, Arike Ogunbowale, Kalia Copper, and Alicia Gray. AT and Fee in particular, I think, have overseas obligations. Saw some tweets from Jackie Powell of The Next a little bit earlier today, so that may be why they aren't included in this camp. Any surprises on the list? Any thoughts on the list?
No surprises on the list. There's a lot of talent there. I'm sure Caitlin Clark will raise some uproar, some discourse. It would be quite the funny bit if there was discourse and then she just couldn't do it because their team is still in the tournament. But yeah, I guess my question to you was going to be, who do you think makes it?
I would say Chelsea's in. I think the four aces are in. Chelsea, Kelsey, Jackie, Shocker. And Asia. I think they're in. Brianna Stewart is going to be in. I think Brittany Griner is absolutely going to be in, especially if this ends up being like her last Olympic go-around. I think Brittany Griner is absolutely going to be in. Jewel Lloyd is going to be in. I think Sabrina is going to be in. Diana Taurasi is also going to be in, which, again, if this is going to be her last go, then they're going to send her off and try to get another gold medal. So I think they are in. From there, it gets interesting.
I believe it's 12 make it, right?
Yeah. So it'll be 12 from there. Like, I would imagine, again, just no Nafisa Collier this time around, but she was in the February camp. She also played in the qualifier game shortly after. So I would imagine Nafisa Collier is in for sure. I would like to see Alyssa Thomas. In terms of just the talent, the skill set, she absolutely should make it. I don't have her as a lock, so we'll see there. I'm trying to think who else gets in. Like, the center room is interesting. Like, I don't know if they want to carry, four traditional, weird to call Asia a traditional center, but for the purposes of this team, it would be weird for them to carry four centers. And then also if they bring AT in to play some five, like Stewie can play some five. Like, I don't know how many front court pieces they want. And like even splitting it up between guards, wings, forwards, and bigs, I feel like Stewie's kind of like the only like four in this training camp roster. And so like I do wonder if they try to balance that out a little bit more.
It feels very Caitlin Clark, Ryan Howard, Shakira Austin. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna go with Fee.
And then that's just it. Yeah, which, again, interesting that Caitlin makes it as someone that was in the Zooms when they had the February camp. A lot of the early questions for when they had like the director up and asking about the roster decisions, stuff like that. A lot of those questions were geared towards, hey, so would you consider having Caitlin Clark here? She's not at camp. Does that mean that she's not going to be at the next one, et cetera, et cetera? So it's just interesting to see her name on the list in light of that portion of it, because we were given some pretty coy answers on that front. And to your point, like, I'm sure there will be discourse. Do not particularly care to get into that much of it, but very talented roster nonetheless. I can't wait to see what the final 12 is actually going to be. Did want to touch on that. On the NBA side, we have hashtag drama, I guess. The Wolves and the Lynx not for sale anymore, per Glenn Taylor. We do have the original statement that was given early on this morning from Glenn Taylor. This morning confirmed the expiration of the option of Mark Lohr and Alex Rodriguez to acquire controlling interest in the Timberwolves and Lynx. Under terms of the purchase agreement, the closing was required to occur within 90 days following the exercise notice issued by Lohr and Rodriguez. That 90-day period expired on March 27th. Under certain circumstances, the buyer could have been entitled to a limited extension. However, those circumstances did not occur. I'm interested in that piece. And then the quote, I will continue to work with Mark, Alex, and the rest of the ownership group to ensure our teams have the necessary resources to compete at the highest levels on and off the court, said Taylor. The Timberwolves and Lynx are no longer for sale. Since then, we have gotten a statement from Lauren Rodriguez saying that they are disappointed with Glenn Taylor's public statement. We have fulfilled our obligations, have all necessary funding, and are fully committed to closing our purchase of the team as soon as the NBA completes its approval process. Glenn Taylor's statement is an unfortunate case of seller's remorse that is short-sighted and disrupted to the team and the fans during a historic winning season. And then Glenn Taylor to The Athletic. We're just saying we had a contract with you guys. You've had your time, and this is the end of the contract, and we're just kind of going to go on running the way we've been run. And a little bit later from Glenn Taylor, I just think I just built this team. We've got the players now, and it appears to me that we should have a very positive run for a number of years, and I want to be a part of that. All of this feels respectfully messy. I ain't gonna hold you. What were your early takeaways from all of that?
Is this a thing that can happen?
I am sure we are about to find out via court.
That seems incredibly messy. Not to make a new hashtag, but we had 19 updates of, hey, they need to find the money, and they find the money. And it's like, cool, we're going to get it approved. And Glenn Taylor, nah.
Hey, congrats on getting that money. You didn't do it within this timeline, though.
Hey, it's a safe space.
Yeah.
He's just kind of hoping they wouldn't find it. Close the keys.
Bro saw the Wolves in the onesies. Like, hey, hold on a minute.
I don't know. This is above me, but...
That seems spicy.
Very.
And I think more than anything, because I'm sure this is going to continue to play out, I just got a feel for the fans. It's like just kind of feeling the vibe there. They seemed very ready for Mr. Taylor to sell and to kind of usher in new ownership and just a new era of Timberwolves basketball. And now we got this. And we have conflicting statements and no sale entering a postseason that you may or may not have Karl Anthony Towns, and the payroll really comes into question heading into this offseason. So it was already going to be a big postseason and big offseason. Now you have this kind of hovering over things, and like, how does that impact what moves they do or do not make this offseason, regardless of how it goes in the playoffs? If they win the title, or if they get knocked out the first round, if Glenn Taylor's still there, like, how does he feel about this current group, and how does he plan on, you know, maintaining the structure if he has plans to do so? It's a lot. And beyond that, just the timing of it, we are what, 2 weeks away, two, 3 weeks away from the playoffs to get this kind of a bombshell in the midst of this season while you are still in play for the one seed. It just feels weird. And so, again, like, I'm not going to pretend to be any kind of legal analyst or anything like that. We will just see how it plays out. We'll get the updates. We'll talk about it when they come. But this all just feels weird and unfortunate for the fan base more than anything.
I guess we'll have an update in April, huh?
The Wolves win game two. Also, Glenn Taylor has now taken the mic post game from Anthony. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens there. Going back to the W, we briefly touched on Victoria Vivian's being waived by the Indiana Fever. The Seattle Storm have signed Vivian's. Did you have any early thoughts on what the fit could be like there?
Did you have any early thoughts?
Like, I think for me, we'll have to see if the jumper bounces back for her. But like, I think she can unlock some small ball stuff for Seattle. Like, she played some, played a lot of three in Indiana, but then it felt like she was best at the four because of her willingness to shoot and shoot from distance in particular. And so I'd be curious to see like what some of Seattle's small ball units look like with her, if they are going to play at the four. Because the Storm, like, you know, they had the press release about the signing because they didn't designate if this is a standard contract or if it's a training camp deal. It's not a guarantee, at least as far as I know, that she makes the roster. But if she does, like, I can kind of see her sliding into that second unit, added some 3-point shooting, at least in terms of volume, and kind of unlocking some lineup versatility for him. So like, those are some of the early thoughts. I do want to see like what the actual contract status is going to be.
Would you rather have Vivian's at the four or Horston at the four?
I would rather have Horston at the four. Very quick answer, I'm sorry, but I would rather have Horston at the four. But if Vivian shoots well enough, or, you know, ideally if both of them shoot well enough, then it's not going to matter that much. But ideally, I say Horston. Like, I think you're going to lock the screening stuff with her to a better degree. More switchability defensively. I'm just high on Jordan Horston at the four moving forward. So I would like for them to carve out as much time there as they can.
Come back to me after the draft.
Yeah, we'll probably get some more movement after.
Because that's where I'm kind of like, okay, what do they do? And then what's that look like overall? That's the tricky part.
I got you. And then on the NBA side, on the signing front, didn't get to it on the earlier in the week show, but Javonte Green back in Chicago on a 10-day deal. Played his first game on Wednesday, had 5 points, 4 boards, and a block in 19 minutes. He was a plus 26 blowout win over the Indiana Pacers. So nice to see just his general energy back on the floor. Flies around defensively. Chicago has used him as a forward. They've used him as a screener. Juices the transition attack. Can catch any lob you throw at him. So just happy to see him back. I know Bulls faithful are too. Let's, as quickly as we can, get through some of the injury updates here. Sixers are optimistic that Joel Embiid will be back before the end of the regular season. Per Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN, he said it is not a question of if, but when he returns. So I had some thoughts like, hey, at what point, you know, if the Sixers slide enough, at what point did they say maybe we shouldn't bring Joel back? Apparently that point has not been reached, and we will see Joel Embiid soon. So that should be cool. Per Paul Hudrick, Joel Embiid practiced today as we record on Thursday. So practice on Thursday, will join the team on his road trip. The Sixers schedule moving forward, they have the Cavaliers on Friday, or they're in Cleveland on Friday to face the Cavs, at Toronto on Sunday. They come back home on Tuesday, April 2nd, to face the Thunder, and then a 3-game road trip from there, at Miami on Thursday, April 4th, at Memphis on Saturday, that's April 6th, and at San Antonio on Sunday, April 7th. So I would imagine I would imagine by the Spurs game or maybe that first home game after that, because they do close the season with 3 straight home games against Detroit, Orlando, and Brooklyn. I think that Pistons game is on Tuesday, April 9th. So like I would imagine like at least by then Embiid's back, if I had to guess. But again, I don't have any reporting on that front.
One, it's good to hear he's coming back. Yeah. Obviously, that means the health is in a good spot. I don't think he would risk it if it was not. If I were to guess, it's tricky for when to bring him back, in all honesty. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he plays on any of the road trips. Do you just bring him back against Miami? But then it's a back-to-back right after? Like, I don't know.
I think between Miami and the Detroit game would probably be the range, if I had to guess. Especially if they want to get, like, a handful of games in for Embiid. If you can ease him in with a homestand. Like that work for me. Like, I think if the OKC game was also a road game, like, one, that would just make the road trip harder, but at least you get the consistent of we just own the road versus two road games, go home, and then we own the road for three, and then we back home. Like, that back and forth just kind of makes it weird schedule-wise. But I'm with you, though. I would love to see him beat back, and if he is back and feeling good, if he's 90% of himself, that certainly makes the playoff picture a lot more interesting. Ooh. Makes the play-in race more interesting. Like, I don't foresee, even if Philly ends up in the play-in when the season ends, like, I don't foresee them losing 2 play-in games.
Is that just because of the Bulls and Hawks?
I mean, yeah. Like, I don't think. Like, all due respect to Vooch and also Clint Capela, I'm not sure either of those two would be happy to see Joel Embiid, even the 85-90% version of himself.
Hey, I hope he's able to knock off a little bit of rust before everything really starts up. But I know everyone has the Eastern Conference jokes, but that, man, that sixth seed feels important right now.
Yeah, it does. I'll
tell you that much. And that 7 and 8 spot feels tough. Like, imagine you're Boston. You have this season.
Congratulations.
And your reward is Miami or Philly with Embiid in the first round. Or you're Milwaukee and you overcome all of this and you make the coaching change. You feel better about the offensive flow, the defensive switching. Hey, here's Miami and or Philadelphia with Joel Embiid. Good luck.
Yeah, I would love that.
Mm-mm. Not ideal.
Yeah, the playoffs are going to be fun, man. Oh, I'm excited.
Can I be respectfully messy real quick?
Sure.
Who's happier right now, Nick Nurse or Tyrese Maxey?
Well, based on last night, the answer is not Kelly Oubre. We know that much. But I would say probably Tyrese Maxey, so he just doesn't see the volume of double teams and traps. Like, nah, y'all can deal with big fella. I can run around a little bit more. Let's have some fun. Also, I guess while we're here, being respectfully messy, how big is that fine going to be?
It'll be nice sized.
Yeah, that's... Because you can't do that. the dunker spot does not condone. But anyway, so shout out to Joel Embiid. Cavs Donovan Mitchell, who's been out with a knee issue and also a nasal fracture, could return as early as Friday against the Sixers. So that's fun. Lakers may be getting Gabe Vincent back. He's traveling with the team and could play as early as Sunday against the Brooklyn Nets. And then on the downside, or on the downturn rather, Hornets guard LaMelo Ball and wing Cody Martin, both out for the rest of the season due to various ankle injuries. LaMelo Ball averaged a career high 23.9 points per game this year, 5 rebounds, 8 assists, nearly 2 steals per game. Cody Martin averaged 7.5 points this year, 4 rebounds and a career high 3.7 assists for the Hornets. I have a LaMelo thought. I'm concerned. I don't know how concerned I should be. I think it's now, 58 games over his last 2 seasons? And they've both kind of ended with ankle stuff. And I've been trying to gauge, like, how much of this is just the ankle should be red flagged. This is a problem moving forward, etc. Should Charlotte think about stuff? Or how much of it is just, you're out, we're also bad. You just chill and get right, and we'll just take these losses. Like, I just don't have that answer. And so, like, that kind of shifts, like, how worried I am about LaMelo, like, health-wise moving forward. I don't know how much of it is that and how much of it is just injury.
Well, if he came back, will we get the Nekias Duncan tweet? Why is he playing?
No. Like, I'm glad Desmond Bane's back. And I think, because I had... Especially in the case of LaMelo, like, I also just have, like, development questions. Like, one of the things we've talked about throughout the history of the pod is, what does LaMelo do inside the arc? How often does he get there? What does he do as a finisher? Like, what does the footwork look like when he gets to his pull-ups or his floaters? Because, like, there's no questioning the shooting touch that he has. But, like, can he clean up some of the mechanical stuff? And so, like, if for no other reason than that, like, I would have loved to see, if he can return, let LaMelo play these last 7 or 8 games. Or 10 games, or whatever the number is. And get him some more driving reps because he needs that. So I would not be in the camp. I don't think I disagree with you that, like, the majority may land on the Hornets are already bad. Why are you playing? Just come back next year. But for me, I want to see him get those reps, especially following a season that also ended prematurely. Like, I just don't want him to fall behind in there. Like, I was looking at, you know, just looking at the Basketball Reference page. He's been in the league 4 years. He has qualified for a scoring title, which you need to play at least 58 games to do that. He's qualified for a scoring title once in 4 years. Like, that's not ideal. And again, I just frankly don't know enough to be like, you know, I don't have his medical info or anything like that, so I don't want to do reckless speculation. But, like, just that number itself, like, that doesn't seem great. So I, you know, just want him to get developmental reps because he is a special talent when he's on. We know what kind of pull-up shooter he can be. We know what kind of passer he can be. And, like, a thought that I was having with myself earlier is, like, how many players in the league even meet the LaMelo threshold? 6'7", can make any pass you want him to, can pull up from anywhere. Like, it's him. Is it just him, Luka, LeBron? Is that just it? Depending on how you feel about the Luka and LeBron jumpers, obviously. And to the other obvious part, like, they're also better than him. But just that archetype, it's kind of those three, no?
Is this purely based on height as well?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Tall, creative. Yeah, like, it feels like that. So, like, that's an exciting talent. I want to see him develop. And so I do hope, like, I hope the ankle just gets right so we can get the extended LaMelo run.
Does Tyrese count?
I think Tyrese is, what, 6'4", 6'5"? Like, he is bigger guard, but he's not legit wing size like LaMelo is.
Wow, you hit me with the amusement park.
you must be this tall to make this skip pass.
Yeah, you put me in a box with this one, bud.
This is why I was, you know, just doing stuff, cleaning up my kitchen or whatever. It's like, how many guys meet like 6'7" plus can make these passes, can will take these shots, can bend defenses like that? Like, I think that's got a.
I have a new contender. List. I have a new contender. Who you said will take these shots. Giannis.
No, absolutely not.
What you mean?
No.
Will he take those shots?
Giannis ain't taking deep pull-ups, though.
Yes, he is. You get mad about it every year.
No, I get mad at him taking threes as a concept. He ain't pulling from 30 like LaMelo. Taking the deep step there. Back from the left wing threes like Luka. I'm not. No, you about to rile me up like this. We Giannis. Absolutely not.
Hey, does Devin Booker count?
No, at least I wouldn't count him. What is Booker even listed as? Is he also like 6'5", 6'6"? Does he? Did they give him 6'7"? Okay, no.
6'6".
Sorry, bud.
Does Jokic count?
No.
What do you mean?
How many pull-up threes has Jokic even taken this year?
Hey, man.
Now you're going to get to the distance part. How many pull-up threes has he taken?
Does Shea count?
No. I don't think Shea, as he's taking more of the threes, but I don't think he crosses that threshold, nor do I think he crosses the passing threshold, frankly.
Julius Randle?
I am about to... All right. Shout out Cody Martin. Some of the passing growth. But no, in all seriousness, like, I do want LaMelo to get healthy. He did make meaningful strides as a driver in the short time that we saw him. Up to, I think, you know, per Clean the Glass, 32% of his shots came at the rim this past season. That was 23% last year. It was 28% the year before that. So it's nice to see him play inside the arc a little bit more than he did. Dealt with contact a little bit better. Still not an elite finisher. Like, there's just room there, which, again, I want to see him play and get better at that aspect. But strides were made. We'll see what happens with LaMelo moving forward.
I have three more contenders.
Okay, what you got?
Scottie Barnes?
No.
Brandon Ingram?
No.
Kevin Durant?
No.
Dang, you've made this an exclusive list. All right, continue.
I'm sorry. There's a blend of size and pull-up shooting and also passing ability that it's incredibly rare. Like, I'm sorry.
Tatum?
No. He sure will take the pull-ups. My word. Let me tell you. But no. And then also, while we're on the injury stuff, just a very quick hat tip to the return of Mitchell Robinson. 8 points, a couple of blocks, and 12 minutes off the bench as the Knicks got yet another blowout win. So I just wanted to get the hat tip there. I'm curious.
Hey, okay. Do you keep him coming off the bench, Nikias?
See, that's what I was about to ask you. I think you let him ramp up off the bench for now. I think once the playoffs roll around, I think I would start Mitch. I think I start him. You get more of the playmaking and some of the hub stuff with Isaiah Hartenstein with that second unit blended in there. But I do think
I'm like intrigued. It seems like it might be tied to Julius Randle in my head, but I'm intrigued.
Yeah. I guess also interesting that Mitchell Robinson returned before Julius Randle. Like, I figured that would have been flip-flopped. So I hope Julius is all right to that point. But we shall see. But we can now move to the mailbag. Once again, thank you to those who sent in questions. You can email us at any time at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Dunkerspot, just the R, not dunkers, but dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Send in your basketball thoughts and questions, and we will get to them. First question is going to come from Rhea, who says, "Hi, guys. Thank you for teaching me how to embrace my bounce. My question is about the charge. Every time there's a hard fall following a charge taken, there's a lot of hashtag discourse about eliminating it from the game for player safety. I understand that it can be a dangerous play for both charger and chargee, but am a bit concerned about removing a tool from a willing defender's toolbox. On one hand, I understand the cries to ban it from a player safety standpoint, but on the other hand, it would feel a bit icky to ban a play that asks an offensive player not to run or jump through an opposing player who is standing there. What are y'all's thoughts on banning the charge? I'll add that I'm a Heat fan, so I'm biased." I respect the disclaimer at the end of the question.
What do you got, Nikai? You got charge bars?
Very boring bars. I am not a proponent of banning the charge, honestly. Like, I do get the player safety element. But if you get beat to the spot, you get beat to the spot. And, like, I do think, you know, being reactive as a driver is a legitimate skill. Being able to map out the floor and where rotations are coming from is a skill. Like, nobody wants to see injuries, obviously. And, like, I do think it's worth looking into, like, how do you penalize or how do you dissuade, like, the super late slide-ins when someone's already airborne? Like, if there is some way to legislate that rule-wise, something like that, to eliminate the scarier aspects of that, then I'll be all for it. Because, again, I don't want to see injuries at the end of the day. But, like, the concept is a charge in general. Like, no, I can't get to ban it.
I would like to see some of the more dangerous ones eliminated. You know, some of that could be rule-based. Also could just be knowing the time, know the personnel, know what's going on. The undercuts, I don't love so much. I don't think you should ban it. You know, I hate to be boring, but it is a skill-based thing. If you know how to draw a charge, it's pretty good. I mean, look at Kyle Lowry.
Yeah.
Man was, that man has drawn some charges.
In Miami, for that matter. But no, like, I think it's a legitimate skill. And, like, to the point of the question, like, a willing defender's toolbox, I think, is important to note. Like, I think anyone can take a charge. Not everyone is willing to do so. And so, like, I don't want to remove that from guys, especially if, like, that helps compensate for a lack of, like, physical tools elsewhere. Like, it can be a form of rim protection if you don't have the vertical pop, if you don't have the wingspan, et cetera. Again, like, you don't want the dangerous stuff or the more dangerous ones. Don't slide. When someone's already left the ground, don't try to slide in and get the call. Like, that's nasty. Don't do that. But, like, if you got the instincts for it and you just don't have, like, the vertical pop to challenge stuff at the rim and you can save 2 points or just flip possession in general, like, I don't think that should be taken away from defenders. Not me. Which, granted, you know, I also watched a lot of Heat basketball in my day. So, like, maybe that also excuses it for me. But I've never been a proponent of banning it outright. Next question is going to come from Fritz, who says, "Hey, guys, this is a question that has bugged me for years now. Whenever I think about Chicago action, which is a pin down that flows into a handoff, it takes me a second to remember if the screen comes before or after the dribble handoff. I know it's before, but that makes me think, why haven't we seen it come after? Or do we see it as just that it's just basically a flare screen after a dribble handoff, or even a double flare screen instead of the dribble handoff? Very much a nerdy question, but I feel like it's one you guys might take off the glass real quick. Thanks. Love the pod."
I apologize that has bugged you for a few years, and I apologize to inform you that we have seen it come after. I'm assuming you mean why is the first player not doing the dribble handoff? Is that correct?
That's kind of how I read it.
I mean, we've seen that. I mean, and one, it's like a basis of a pistol action to a degree. Guard dribble handoffs to another guard. Big comes, cleans it up. I'm trying to think of a couple actions. Like, I think there was like an ATO one time. Someone ran horns. And then you just dribble off and do a handoff to the dude in the corner. And the big turns around and flips and screens it. So, I mean, there's ways you can do it. I won't go on my play call terminology rant. It just depends on who you want to deliver the handoff. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Generally, you want the big to be the second screener. So the big ends up involved in the action. has to perform a coverage. And so whether you hit the big first and the guard screens or the guard handoffs and the big screens, you're still just trying to force them to navigate and allow someone to get the ball at pace. So, I mean, I my mind went right to Cleveland. Well, one of the first things they did to try and integrate Donovan Mitchell and Garland was just a handoff between those two. And now they're flying off a big. So I don't know if you want to call that Chicago or Milwaukee or Wisconsin or Zoom. It's just, you know, it's just hoops. I mean, sometimes you can disguise it and try and bait a team into switching if you want to, like, put all wings in it. But that's a real matchup, honey, type deal.
There we go. Wise words from Professor Steve. Also, we could just call it Ohio just for the bit. But there we go. Next question going to come from Maxfield. We'll note that this was sent in on March 24th, if you want to have that background. But I'm watching the women's tournament and Camila Cardoso dominate UNC. I'm wondering what the ideal archetype is for a WNBA star. Caitlin Clark is Caitlin Clark, but it feels like the WNBA is dominated by bigs. Is that just because of Stewie, Asia, and Alyssa Thomas being all-time talents, or is there something about the women's game that makes bigs more valuable?
Good question. I feel like, to a degree, I don't know if there's one specific archetype for a W star, especially as the game continues to evolve. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of always been that way, you know? You think back throughout the history, like, yeah, you had your Lisa Leslies, you had Tina Thompson, you had Lauren Jackson, you had Sylvia Fowles, you also had Cynthia Cooper and Cheryl Swoops and Shamika Holdsclaw, Maya Moore, Diana Taurasi, Katie Smith, Becky Hammon. There's always been an element of people who can score, bigs who can do things. I just feel like maybe it's just been louder what the elite bigs can do. Mm-hmm. And maybe, especially these days, if we're talking Stewie, we're talking Asia, we're talking AT, the versatility they have now also jumps off the page to a degree. Mm-hmm. And like, if you have a great big, how much can you really do with them? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. What do you do with a Brittany Griner? How do we handle that? Maybe that's what causes the difference. But I don't think it takes away. Like, you don't have to be just a big to make it work, in my opinion. You know what I'm saying? What say you?
I'm glad you went first, because I knew you would have a better handle on, like, the historical context of this than I would. Because, like, I read the question, you know, it feels like the WNBA is dominated by bigs. Like, my early thought was, like, yeah, you go back. It feels like you mentioned Lisa Leslie already, Lauren Jackson, Sylvia Fowles, Brittany Griner, et cetera. Like, it's felt like the league's best players, for the most part, have been front court players. There have been wings, there have been guards, but a lot of the talent pool is kind of, you know, directed towards the front court players. And I think, like, zooming out, I wonder if that's just because of, like, we haven't gotten the full-blown shooting revolution in the W yet. Or at the very least, we haven't had the pull-up shooting revolution in the W, like we've seen on the NBA side. To where, like, it grew to a point to where we were having, you know, you can follow on either side of the debate there. But, like, you kind of, it led to conversations like, hey, how can we play drop coverage right now? If teams are taking these pull-ups and they're taking them from deeper out and they're spacing the floor to this degree. Like, we haven't had that happen in the W yet, to where it shifts how teams are scouting, what types of players they're prioritizing, and thus that trickling down to, okay, what types of players are these colleges scouting now? If your thing is we win a lot and we get these players to the league, that's part of the selling point. We need to kind of shift our program to what gets those players there. And so because we haven't had that on the W, haven't had it on the college side, and thus skilled size and size overall still wins to a large degree. I do think we're starting to see a little bit of the shift, though. Like, even within the big, Steve talked about the versatility, like Candace Parker's the first person that comes up to mind for me. But like, even with Asia, she's a big, but, and she could put people underneath the basket, but you think more of the face-ups with Asia. And now you look at what's happened the last couple of years with Becky Hammon, like, year one, she's taking more threes, starting to see the modernization there. Last year, didn't take as many threes, also didn't hit them to the same degree, but now you see Asia being moved around a bunch. It's not just guard sets cross-screen for a post-up or a face-up. Now it's Asia coming off staggers. So, like, you're starting to see it expand. So I don't think I think we're going to see different types of players become stars. And like, I think even beyond Caitlin Clark, like, I think part of the excitement with Sabrina Ionescu coming out was the pull-up shooting and the way that she was able to bend defense. Like, oh, this is, it's really good, but also this is different than what we've seen. We've seen guards dictate games with their scoring. We've seen guards dictate things with their shooting. We haven't seen 28, 30, 31 foot pull-ups with like legit volume in an efficiency clip that we're okay with. And now we're seeing a similar element with Caitlin Clark to where, oh, she will pull from anywhere. That's not, obviously that's not all she does. Like, I, you can make an argument, like the passing may be better than the scoring, which is wild. But just conceptually, she brings a different dynamic for how she wins. And so I think as we get, you know, Caitlin in, Sabrina continues to grow. Like, I'll lean on people that watch more and are smarter than me in this aspect. But like, it, from who I've talked to, it feels like there is going to be an influx of more dynamic guard play. If we get enough of those guards in the W, that may shift what the ideal star looks like. Or as we see more wings doing guard things or more bigs doing wing things, like that may shift what constitutes as a star. Like, I think at the foundation of it, your WNBA star is the player that can consistently draw two and punish your defense and or can bend things defensively. Like, that part isn't going to change. That's mostly been bigs. But to the Stewie point, she can hurt you from literally anywhere. We see with some of these guards in, like, if they're able to stretch the floor and pull up, and now you're getting two on the ball, that's opening up short roll stuff, et cetera, and now they're just blasting you defensively. Like, that could also be a different way to go about it. So I think we're starting to see the ship. It's just kind of trended towards big so far. And ultimately, this is a pretty young league still.
Well, now my mind goes to Arike and Jewel Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And like, Kaylin McBride and Ryan Howard and the shots she started to take. The Marina Mabrys of the world. I think there's a lot of versatility. So I think there's a lot of different lanes you can fill to have that kind of success in the W, which is fun. Because there's going to be a lane for those type of bigs, like Bree Jones, to a degree. But it doesn't. I don't think it automatically leads to XYZ like it did at a certain time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And like, I think that's also, just to quickly bounce off of that, like, that's also what makes me even more excited, I guess, for just what Aaliyah Boston can become moving forward. Because it felt like she fit more, at least watching her college, like it felt more of the traditional dominant star big archetype. But you watch more closely, like, you know, the passing flashes were there at South Carolina. And then you got to see some of that really pop in the second half of the year with Indiana. She sprinkled in some threes where she wasn't doing that at South Carolina. And so, like, you get enough of those seeds, like, oh, wait, what all can Aaliyah do? And I guess in tandem, like, what are Aaliyah and Caitlin going to do together, assuming that's the pick? And how is that going to shift? Who's a star? What is a star duo? How do you build around those? How do you scheme for that? And I think it's going to really supercharge the thought process across the league. And that should, you know, so it should lend itself to even more versatility coming into the league, being prioritized, the shifting kind of the game is played, and kind of goes on and on from there. So I'm excited. I really like this question, by the way. Next one is going to come from Anthony, our guy, longtime listener and appreciator. Good day, gentlemen. Hope everything is well with both of you, and happy to see those Coach's Corner videos. They are fantastic. Continued success, Nikai and Steve. Appreciate you, big dog. My question this time is related to defending Denver in the playoffs. Obviously, the Jokic-Murray two-man game has been so effective that it might be unstoppable. In the Western Conference, which team has the best five-man lineup to combat not only that, but Gordon in the, stares at the camera, dunker spot scenario that Jokic has repeatedly taken advantage of, especially against the most talented defense in the league in Boston? Not only your favorite five-man lineup, but what would be your specific strategy to find something to live within that matchup? I'll hang up and listen. All the best, guys.
Woo, that's a banger of a question. I'll put it that way. So let's see if we can dive into it, dunker spot style.
Okay.
And hard question. It got my head and made me think of the Jamal Murray thought that's been lingering in the back of my brain for like 3 to 4 months, to where, hey, he feels like the key to take away for Denver, but you eventually have to deal with some sort of action with Nikola Jokic. And what you decide on defensively now can open either Jokic up or Murray up, and you still have to deal with the problem. So even if he's missing shots, the problem doesn't necessarily go away. Mm-hmm. And it makes it even more difficult because Jokic makes switches feel uncomfortable. He makes drop feel uncomfortable, makes two on the ball feel uncomfortable. Just doesn't feel good. Like, I think there's an essence of that in the game with the most elite players, where there's a timing deal where you can come up with a game plan, you can think it's going to be the best thing for you, and then it doesn't work and you're searching. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I go to my mind, just Dallas and Sacramento just played. I don't mean to veer off too far, but the Kings were like, hey, Domantas Sabonis, you guard PJ Washington. We'll put Harrison Barnes on a big, we'll be fine. That'll be a switch. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then Dallas was like, you know what we can do? Use PJ Washington as a screener. And now it's like, oh no, two on the ball, that's a pop. Oh no, okay, let's switch. Oh, Luka made the shot immediately. Okay, maybe let's not switch. You know, there's just kind of that rhythm where you're searching for it as a defense. The offense responds, and now you just are like, well, how many of these can we live with? And I feel like that's where it comes down to with Denver. What are you willing to live with, and how long are you willing to live with it? And I feel like a lot of teams have found things that have worked against Denver. The issue is the Denver Nuggets have seen almost everything, right? Mm-hmm. And whatever you find has to not just work, it has to work over the course of 48 minutes. And if we're talking about a playoff series, it has to work game to game. And that's where it becomes very difficult, because this is a team that makes it very hard for you once you show your hand. Because now they know. You know, Jokic has the data now. So, okay, I know what y'all about to do. Like, I was watching the Phoenix-Denver game that they just had. And I was like, hey, this is pretty neat. Phoenix just kind of said, you know what? KD, switch that Gordon pick and roll. And then we'll just double. Hey, Grayson Allen, you just stand on Jokic for a second. We'll just double with Eubanks. That's cool, but you have to rotate behind it now. Yeah. And then if you don't nail the rotations or Jokic decides to score, can you stick with it? You know, can you stick with it? I feel like that's the real challenge. And when you go to like the 5-man lineups, right? Mm-hmm. Which route do you want to go? Is it a big lineup with size and length to where, hey, we have 3 or 4 wings out here? Maybe our quote-unquote one is 6'4", 6'5", and we have a center, and we feel comfortable with, okay, we can handle that one-on-one coverage, or at least pick a poison. Is it a small lineup with a wing that you feel okay defending Jokic? Do you go with someone who, in theory, could just, you want to say handle Jokic one-on-one, but, hey, you just got that. You just got to live with that. Is it trying to have someone who can bother Murray? Is it someone who could guard Murray and Gordon so you can at least switch that portion? Do you want to have size on Gordon so you have help in the paint? My best theory is you have to be able to mix coverages, and you're going to have to be able to live with them punishing you. I think commitment's the number one thing. This is what we're doing right now. We can mix, you know, in... The other part is, it's not like, is there a best way to double Jokic? The man sees everything. So if you're thinking, okay, we'll just double him when he starts his move, whop.
Yeah.
So that was my first thought. Boston feels like the one for me. In all honesty, you've got White and Drew who can guard multiple positions. You got Tatum and Brown who have size and length. Pick a big, let's go. Mm-hmm. Clippers?
That'd be what, Zoo on Jokic? Are you putting Kawhi on Aaron Gordon? Paul George on Jamal Murray? Is that the thought there?
I mean, the thought feels gross no matter what you think about it. But.
it's Jokic and Murray at the end of the day. So, like, it's not going to feel great either way. But
I guess here's the other part that we aren't even going to talk about is you also need to have this lineup be able to score.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, if I go Clipper brain, What if they threw Russ out there with James, Terrence Mann, Paul George, and Kawhi?
It feels really small against.
See?
That group. Yeah,
see?
Okay. That gets hazy.
See? Okay. You're not wrong. Pelicans?
In theory, I guess. I think they have the requisite front court strength between JV and Zion to deal with some of the Jokic and Gordon stuff in particular. But we will just say that Jokic does not mind the JV matchup if you're not going to send help. And, like, again, Zion has the strength thing, but, like, Aaron Gordon is bigger than him. So okay. Even if you want to, like, try to switch some of the early offense, Gordon sets a screen for Jokic. Now it's 6'5 Zion. As strong as he is, maybe bothered the base a little bit, but it's still going to be like 6'4, 6'5 Zion against Jokic at that point. It's like, eesh. Like, my first thought was Minnesota.
And like, if they you get, would.
Well, I mean, yeah. And I was like, well, if they're healthy, you go with Cat on Jokic, like, try your best and be strong. Rudy Gobert, you defend Aaron Gordon and just play the cat and mouse. Either come with a double if you feel like you need to, or you know, kind of stunt and dig. So if Jokic tries to flip in a lob behind you, you can challenge that. And then you're putting, I guess, you could put Jaden McDaniels on Jamal Murray if you want to turn some of the 1-4 stuff into switches. I guess the screen navigation point is where I get tricky for me. Because, like, I think Jaden McDaniels is a better defender, but, like, I feel like I would probably want Nickeil Alexander-Walker on Jamal Murray for all of the screens he's got to navigate. But then that kind of takes away your ability to, at least in theory, it makes it less effective if you're now switching, like, Murray-Gordon stuff off ball. And now it's Gordon is putting Nah underneath the basket. So I think my best three-person configuration would be Jaden on Jamal Murray, Rudy on Aaron Gordon, Cat on Jokic, or if Cat's just going to be out, I guess Kyle Anderson on Jokic. And shade your help from there. And then your other two would have to be, I think, with Conley and, well, you have Conley and Ant.
Can they go big?
And go with Ant, Jaden, Kyle, Cat and Rudy? Bricks? I mean, there you could. There might be. I mean, and then the other part, think about it, because you mentioned, like, you have to be able to score on the other end. Like, in theory, you would also, you know, if your theory is we need to take Jamal Murray away, you also have to have a lineup that not only can you score with, but you can also put at least some strain defensively on Murray, too. I think that's part of what, like, the Lakers have run into. To where they've tried the cross match in the front court, let AD roam around, have somebody bother Murray. Then on the other end, like, I think about the matchup earlier this year, to where they tried to do the cross matching and stuff. But then it's Jamal Murray, you just chill on Cam Reddish in the corner. It's like, well, if he can still rest on defense, then he can still get you late in the game. You know what I mean? So, like, is there a configuration where you feel good enough defensively about this? In terms of the personnel, you feel good enough about the strategy. You also can score with your overall unit, and you also have players / actions that you can actually make Jamal Murray work in. On top of that,
that's where I point to Boston.
Yeah,
and or Phoenix's ability to just score against Denver. Mm-hmm. You know what? Is the best way to beat Denver just scoring? Like, you know what? Bleep that. We just got to score on this end. They're going to do what they do over here.
Let me tell you, as someone that's watched many of the Heat Nuggets games over the last few years, which, hey, man, yeah, Jokic only got 19 tonight. The Nuggets with a 103 offensive rating. Woo! The Heat have a 91. what did any of that mean? It might just be Bucks. What's up?
Can I lob a different one at you?
Sure.
I thought you were going to go OKC.
Well, I'll tell you what, they'll certainly answer your double team question one way or the other. they will give your answer to what's the best way to double Jokic, which honestly, it's within the context of having to deal with Aaron Gordon too. Like, it's probably easier to double from the top than from the baseline. Like, Denver isn't a high volume 3-point shooting team. So like, the bet may just be double from up top, rotate behind that, force them to take more threes than they want. And you get the long rebounds and all that good stuff. If you're doubling baseline, Jokic is going to see it 8 out of 10 times. And you got to hope that your sync guy is both on, got to be on time. You also have to be big enough to deal with Aaron Gordon and or be able to jump with Aaron Gordon. And like, you know, you bring up OKC. I am just, again, very high volume of double teams from them. They have the speed to pull it off. And like, they had some success doubling Jokic this year. I think about who's going to be in that weak side corner. If that's three out there, he's been pretty inconsistent. It's like that weak side guy. And you can just play with that. And even if you sub three out and now you have Aaron Wiggins in that spot, or you have Kimmich Williams in at that spot, or you have Gordon Hayward in at that spot, you're running into a more dramatic version of the size thing to have to deal with Aaron Gordon. That gets kind of hazy. Because, like, I guess that's what worries me. And, like, I've talked about this a little bit with Jalen Williams, where I've appreciated the work that he's done defensively. And he's had to take on a lot of fours. But, like, this doesn't feel like the matchup that he can even – I don't know if OKC has that available to them with Jalen Williams, to where we put our four on Jokic, let Chet roam. Because, like, that is just not fair to Jalen to give him that matchup against Jokic. And it's not a guarantee that – you know, Chet navigates on the back end well anyway. I think he'd be fine doing it. Like, he has good instincts at the rim. But if Jokic just moves Jalen Williams, and now you just have him taking those hits, you need Jalen on the offensive end to take some pressure off of Shea as a scorer and playmaker. I don't want him taking multiple bumps from Jokic if he doesn't have to. Like, do you give Lu Dort that matchup? Like, if you're trying to do the cross-match thing specifically. Put Dort on Jokic, be annoying, draw a charge, get a deflection, see what you can do.
That sounds great until Jokic decides, actually, I'm just going to run down here.
He does the whole pass and cut thing.
Yeah, and then he just, I don't know, now I got you, flip the hips, deep seal. I don't know, that's tough.
Yeah. So, like, I don't think they can, yeah. It's funny thinking, like, this is, the Thunder have beaten the Nuggets this year. But again, like, it's different. Think about, okay, y'all got seven games at max. You know, you might have seven games of this. What is your base plan? The Lakers do still have, like, the collective size. Is it just them? If we get a 1-8 or a 2-7, is it?
Why don't you be like the Kings or something like that?
It'd be a very funny bit. Harrison Barnes just plays the best defense of his life. You've got to be freaking kidding me.
DeMontis Sabonis handling Jokic single coverage.
Oh, Lord.
Do we throw the Warriors in this conversation at all?
No. I ain't trying to get at the Trace. I don't. God bless Kevon Looney.
Oh, those weren't the names I was thinking of.
Oh no, we getting there. starting with the quote unquote traditional center room first, and then there's Draymond, who, you know, historically has done as best as you can against Jokic individually. However, there's no telling if Draymond Green will be available. I don't know. And as such, also, the Warriors just firm. Do we know if the Warriors are going to make the play-in yet? So, like, there's also that. And I guess related to that, like, I don't know if Houston has a great answer. Just sprinkle that in there. God bless Jock Landale. they decide to size up a little bit, but I don't think that's going to be the... Is there a West playoff / play-in team that we've missed?
Nah, I think we just cycling
through the West at this point.
I think we covered the West.
Yeah, I think that... So... But yeah, the Minnesota final answer for me on the West front.
I'll just stick with Boston.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, as we shift back to the East, we got a quick question from Austin who says, hi, guys. EPM says this is Lillard's best defensive season of his career. Does that jive with your eyes?
I was told that Damian Lillard can't play defense. Wasn't that a thing earlier this year?
Yes.
Wrong. False. He's been pretty good, man.
Okay.
Now, is it his best defensive season of his career? Probably. Is he asked to do more defensively? Also, probably. I don't know if there's a correlation there, but yeah, you've seen the screen navigation, you've seen the help defense, seen the charges, switching, ball pressure. He has done it. He has done his job. What say you as a resident? What's the word I'm looking for here?
Blazers guard defense. Questioner throughout the history of the pod. Yeah. It's so funny. I saw this question and put it in the doc, and I was like, I feel like there was a Portland year where I was like, hey, Dave's kind of doing it right now. This is neat, and so I just went to. Well, I looked up some old tweets to see if I had like actually tweeted if it was just like a pod thought. It looks like it was just a pod thought that I've given. And you gave me the very understandable, this coming from you. So there's that. And then even just pulling up EPM or DEPM, I guess at this point, Dame is at a plus 0.7 this year for Milwaukee. His highest would have been the 2017-18 season in Portland, where he's a plus 0.6. So I guess that, at least statistically, that would be the year to go back and look at to make the argument. Like, I do feel like vaguely there is a Portland year that I probably feel a little bit better about. But
I can tell you what year it was not, 2020-21.
It sure wasn't.
Nekias Duncan, June 1st.
We got to talk about Dame's defense.
On social media.
Oh, nah, because it... Hey, you know what his DPM was that year? Oh, good.
Do I want to know?
We'll just say it was negative. So, yeah. But yeah, it's been a roller coaster watching Dame on defense. Like, he puts in the effort. I mean, they're just going to be like size limitations to some stuff. You know, I'm not holding him to like the Drew standard or anything like that. But like, there's, you know, generally there's a baseline level of effort I want to see. And like, even to, you know, you alluded to earlier, the conversation around Dame earlier this year, like in transition in particular, there was some loitering around and not getting back and stuff like that. Like he can't afford to have those. If you already have like an offensive burden and you kind of need to conserve energy stuff anyway, or if you just have the inherent physical limitations, like you don't have like the plus 8 wingspan or the super vert or great net, like you can't have those built in limitations and also like not get back on defense. So like that stuff you just can't have. But like in terms of the general half court effort from him, like I feel like he's executing the scheme. Screen navigation still ain't great, but he is fighting over. When they do try to scramble him out, he's generally getting out of there in a timely fashion. He's not getting hung up or being lost on where his guy is supposed to be and all that good stuff. So like he's firmly in do your job territory for me. And if that's, you know, I wouldn't sneeze anyone saying this has been the best defensive season of his career, especially post, you know, first 15 games of the year.
Can I be respectfully messy? Does he do 80% of the defense that Terry Rozier does?
That's a tremendous callback. Probably. Probably like 70%. But yeah, probably. that's a tremendous shot. Well done. Well done. You deserve a pat on the back on that one. Any more Dame thoughts while we're here? Defense or otherwise?
Nah.
Ooh. Oh, I meant to ask you this in the watch party. I do have a Bucks question related to Dame. as I was watching the Bucks Lakers game, and I guess just in general since Chris Middleton's come back, like they've gone just looking at how they stagger the lineups. And we've kind of seen like Giannis plus bench. Like there was a Giannis, Pat Connaughton, Jay Crowder, Bobby Portis, and who else was on the floor? Maybe I think Adrian Green was on the floor early on, then there was someone else. But either way, it was like Dame and Chris Middleton on the bench at the same time. And I didn't love that. Because while I am here for shifting to more like Giannis on-ball stuff and letting him and Pat Connaughton do inverted pick and roll, stuff like that, it would be cool. Oh, that was the other lineup. They had Malik Beasley instead of Adrian Green. That was the one. And I was like, I love leaning into more as Giannis as a pick and roll ball handler. Like I feel like I've cited on the pod before. Like he's ranked highly as a pick and roll ball handler in each of the last like 3 or 4 years. But I do wish as they've gotten healthier now, like I would like to have one of the two ball handlers on the floor with him at all times, if you can help it. Cause I feel like it has to be Giannis handle or who else can create an advantage in the guard room. Like Pat isn't bending anything. Malik Beasley isn't bending anything. Like who can unlock Giannis was kind of my thought. And so like, did you have any, has that been on your radar at all? Like it's very early in the Chris Middleton and Dame are on the floor together or they're healthy at the same time bandwagon. So that was just a thought I had at the end of that game.
Who would you rather see?
Like, I think with how they've done it, because like normally Giannis plays what, like the first five or first six, takes a mid-quarter break and then comes in, close out the first quarter, stuff like that. Like, even if it's Chris instead of, I guess, like Jay Crowder in this aspect, in this case. Like, I'm fine with staggering Dame and Giannis, but I don't know if I like Dame and Chris resting at the same time. Like, I want someone that can run something with Giannis and actually hit him and has the chance to, like, bend defense. Like, maybe that's just going to end up being more of a playoff thing and we just see it and it doesn't matter. But, like, that was something that popped for me during the Laker games. Like, huh.
Let me think about this for a second because I'm wondering how much of this is...
It's like minutes restriction stuff for Chris?
Some of that and also just the wave aspect defensively to a degree. You know, mm-hmm. where Bobby comes in for him. And then Giannis comes in for Brooke. So you end up having someone who protects Bobby when he shows to a degree. And I wonder if that's just what they're valuing more. And maybe Giannis gets more touches, involve himself some more, that type of beat, more than anything else. I mean, it'll be interesting in the playoffs how they go about it. But I just wonder if that's maybe the decision or the split they've made.
It could be, especially if like, you know, you start the game with their starters and you have Dame and Chris out there. It just kind of feels like even usage wise, it's Giannis, you're going to screen to start. And then as they go to the bench, now Giannis do stuff. It's like, I get that conceptually if that's the bit, but I do wonder if it's worth maximizing. Like, okay, we can't just shift more usage to Giannis, but also I don't want this to be the only usage for Giannis, if that makes sense.
Well, also I wonder because Dame ends up playing deep in that first quarter. At least that's been the shift. So will the answer just end up being Chris once he's healthier?
Yeah.
That's probably where it gets interesting.
Yeah. I got you. Just figured I'd ask. That's something popped for me. Appreciate you, big dog. Next question going to come from Steven. We'll note quickly that this was sent in March the 22nd. So about a week ago, depending on when you get this one. But we have a Tyrese Halliburton question. Hi, Nikias and Steve. I'm writing to ask you about the narrative around Halliburton's recent slump. In addition to yourselves, both the great Caitlin Cooper and Zach Lowe have cited Buddy Hield's departure as a primary reason for Halliburton's struggles and the Pacers' mediocrity post-All-Star break, in addition to Halliburton appearing to be less than 100% healthy. Per PvPstats.com, Halliburton has shot 41% from three on 122 attempts with Hield off the court before the hamstring injury, which was actually slightly higher than when Hield was on the court during that time. His assists per 100 possessions were also very similar pre-injury with and without Buddy on the floor. As we all know, Halliburton struggled mightily from three since returning from the hamstring injury, shooting only 29% from downtown in that time. His three-point rate, two-point percentage, and free throw percentage are all similar pre- and post-injury, so it feels like the vast majority of Tyrese's slump can be attributed to his three-point shooting and the downstream effects that's had on his ability to put pressure on the defense. His assist rate is also down post-injury. I feel like this also explains the Pacers' mediocrity during this time. I don't doubt that losing Buddy has hurt their offense some, but I wonder how much that's been offset by their improvements on defense. The Pacers' defensive rating is 5 points better this season in minutes without Hield, and it was more than 7 points better without him in the games between when they traded for Siakam and when they traded Hield to Philly. Considering Halliburton's true shooting dropped from 64% pre-injury to 55% post-injury, I'm actually impressed they've played 500 balls since then. Am I oversimplifying? Thanks for producing such a positive and educational space for both the NBA and WNBA.
What'd you think?
Well, for oversimplifying after like three paragraphs is just funny as a concept, but in all seriousness,
bars!
all jokes, we are good. But no, in all seriousness, like I do think it's fair to wonder about like the overall effect of Buddy not being there, because like as the question alludes to, and like I'll say again, like Buddy not being there offensively, I do think led to some sort of like process shifting to how to get to things. And how they would have been defense. Like, not having that movement element shifted Tyrese to, like, something that Caitlin's brought up. They run, you know, as a team that runs stack, pick, and roll a bunch, like, you would have Buddy Hield at the bottom of that, lifting up and choosing which direction he wants to go off to, flying out, all that good stuff. Now Tyrese becomes the movement shooter. Like, if he receives the ball, he's getting it in a different context. Or when he's taking threes, he's taking it in a different context versus just you switch or you duck under, you gave me too much space, I can just stop and pop. Now off movement, like that's a different context for him. Not that he can't do that. And as you talked about, like, you know, before the injury, he was shooting well from three without Buddy on the floor. And it's not like he never was the bottom of the stack action in particular before the trade and before the injury. But like, it is different if you got to bump the volume up on that. And in general, like defenses are defending some of your actions differently without Buddy being there. So I think that context is important to the overall effect of Buddy not being there. Like, yeah, the defense has been better. If you're replacing Buddy's minutes with more Ben Shepherd or more Andrew Nembhard or more Aaron Nesmith, if he just gets a bump because the wing and guard room is different, then like, yeah, like the defense is going to be better. And that could lead to them just being a better team moving forward. Like, I think that's part of the calculus of trading Buddy Hield to begin with. So like, I think that portion is fair. Like, I don't think, or at least I hope we didn't give off the impression that Tyrese is only struggling because Buddy's gone. Like, I think that is just a part of things feeling different and them having to adjust. And then you add on the injury on top of that, which the injury is just the biggest part of why he started shooting the way he did. Like, I think that's just pretty clear. But I think it's fair enough. Like, I think the offense having to shift and find itself again, I think that played a part into the overall comfort. Like, it's hard enough to establish a rhythm when you are number one option and teams are trying to take you away to begin with. You add on injury and then also your personnel changing and thus your play calls changing and thus the alignment changing. It's hard to establish a rhythm. And then he had the minutes restriction when he came back on top of that. So it made it even harder to build a rhythm. So I think everything just kind of blended in itself.
I think it all came together at the right time. And especially, I think that kind of impacts the type of shots you take. When you take them, how you're taking them, are you leaning too much on the shot because the burst isn't where it could or should be? Or are you mad trying to save up so you can have the burst? You know, that kind of plays into it too. I do think the defense trade-off point is an interesting one, especially as this team has worked to navigate and build up towards the playoffs and you're having to play more of those guys that have some of that size, that length. I mean, they gave up a ton of points to the Lakers, but there's a little more fight on that end. And that should help them. You know, I'm with them, like, in a playoff context with the playoff game plan. Does it look different when they have a specific thing we're looking to take away or specific ways we're trying to defend you as opposed to this is our base, mm-hmm. we're going to run?
And just very quickly, because I mentioned at the top that email was sent in on the 22nd. It was sent at about 6 p.m. Eastern, so it was before the Pacers-Warriors game. In the four games since that email was sent, Tyrese Halliburton shooting 44.1% from three on 8.5 attempts. So very conveniently timed, which really just our fault. We just got really my fault. So it is funny that the shooting is seeming to bounce back as of late. Hopefully that continues. But there you go.
Oh, what's up? Oh, wait, hold on. Well, yeah, that was during that, what, 4-for?
Yeah, it was nasty.
Dang, that was March 1st and March 20th. That was oh
yeah. All right, from March 1st onward, 0-6 against New Orleans, 0-6 against New Orleans, 0-6 against the Spurs, 3-10 against Dallas, 2-7 against Minnesota, one of six against Orlando, two of six against OKC, one of six against Chicago, one of nine against Brooklyn, one of nine against Cleveland, and one of three against Detroit. So it was hate. So it makes sense why he don't sit then. And then since then, four of eight mm-hmm. against Golden State, two of six against the Lakers in that very high scoring game. But then six of nine from three against the Clippers, three of 11 against Chicago. So even with that, it's been a little topsy-turvy, but that averages out again, 44% from three on nearly nine attempts over his last four.
Glad he's getting back to business. It's going to be fun to see the Pacers in the playoffs.
There we go. Man's a hooper. Next question going to come from Wes, who says, Nekias and Steve, the Sixers are my team, and watching them recently, I've been noticing some improvements to Kelly Oubre's passing game. When he gets to spots where he runs into a double team or is attacking a rotation, he's finding open kickouts to the perimeter or easy drop-offs to the dunker in spots where earlier in the season, he was just forcing up the bad shot. I've sanity checked this fit in the stat sheet, and it looks at least somewhat real, with his assists jumping from their season average of 0.9 to up around 3 in his last 10. I know that's still nothing to write home about, but for a guy who's ideally your third or fourth option, it feels like a decent spot to be in just to see the simple pass and not force up the bad shots as such. The question I have for y'all is whether you think this type of growth will be enough for Kelly to be a functional starter on a team with championship aspirations. His shooting splits have been sketchy lately, but from the eye test, it feels like his shot selection has improved, and when his usage goes back down to with the return of Embiid, I'd hope those can pop back up a bit. I know from his time in Charlotte that Kelly had a pretty bad rep as being an offensive dead end who overall hurts you by always forcing up a shot once the ball finds him. But watching his effort, I can't help but find myself rooting for the guy and hoping he can grow and stick around in Philly. All that said, I'm still sensitive to making smart business decisions to maximize Embiid's window for the next few years. So I guess I just want to check in and see if you had takes about how the process has been for Kelly in Philly this year.
I liked Kelly Oubre's fit in Philly from the start. Obviously, it becomes a little more uneven when Embiid went down, but his ability to shoot and score and self-create, but also you can use him in different actions. He can make quick decisions. The context fit his game a little bit more to where he has the freedom to do some of the scoring that he does, the driving that he does. You know, you need him to create some of those buckets. You got to live with some of those, but also not need it every single time. And so I feel like that's been the most important part. I think Kelly Oubre can work. It's just which version of Kelly Oubre do you need? What's around Kelly Oubre? And I think Philly's been a nice sweet spot for him. Mm-hmm. So I think specifically next to Embiid, I probably like the fit a lot more. If he was somewhere else, okay, who's he playing with? What are the minutes like? Probably more questions come in, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a shot at Kelly Oubre's game, but I think he's reached the right spot. It's going to be interesting because this is the tricky part of the prove it aspect that's going on these days where, hey, you can add a talent for a year. They're probably going to outperform that, mm-hmm. get the attention from other teams. What do you do? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if Kelly Oubre enters the Bruce Brown atmosphere, but there may be a team that's like, hey, man, got 12, 15 for you. Come on down. Now what?
I got you. And then just to bounce off of that, like one, just good eye. And I think something that we talk about conceptually is like, you know, having fun in the journey and finding the growth and piecing through like some of the process stuff with your favorite teams or favorite players. So like, even when things aren't ideal, no Embiid, a lot of other Sixers have been in and out of the lineup. You can at least point to, okay, this is getting better. And now we can kind of figure out when we get everyone here, how does it fit? How do you blend it in, et cetera? And so with Oubre, like, yeah, I'm with you. Like, I do feel like the shot selection has been a little bit better for him. And to Steve, like, what's around Oubre, I feel like that's kind of been the thing with Oubre. We know he's athletic. We know he can slash. We know he can attack the basket. This jumper has been streaky, but like, in, you know, conceptually, he can knock down open shots if you give them to him. What is the system and who do you have around him? And I think the big thing for Oubre, why it's been, you know, inconsistent for him, one, actually before even getting into the basketball stuff, one, I'm just glad he's still playing this season. Like, the fact that we are even having a conversation about basketball growth based on earlier in the year is a blessing in and of itself. So there's that. But to the basketball portion, you saw how comfortable he looked playing off of Embiid and playing off of Maxey and playing off of, you know, Tobias when he was shooting well, at the very least. You kind of simplify what he has to do. they're probably going to double here, or they're going to show extra attention on this Tyrese drive. This is my pocket of space. I catch and shoot. If you close out too aggressively, I catch and drive. And then I have a shot or a pass. And once you remove that ready-made context, because guys are out, one, he has a sensor, a higher sense of responsibility in terms of scoring. We ain't got Embiid. Somebody has to do it. If you throw in, like, again, it's been a very inconsistent year for Tobias Harris. We'll call it that. Okay, we don't have Embiid. Tobias doesn't have it either. I need to take some of these. I need to get going. I need to put some points on the board. We need to get some free throws, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that can blend in. The fact that he's been able to fight some of that and make some of these passing reads, as simple as they are, that's encouraging. Because it feels like a continuation of when they had the full complement, I can just make these reads. I can attack this closeout and just make this decision and we're good to go. And so getting into like the numbers of it, I'll also say good eye on your part. Just per NBA.com's tracking data on the year, Kelly Oubre passing on 16.4% of his drives this year. Last year, that was at 12.7. Now, to the point about, again, the context, what's around him, stuff like that. The year before that in Charlotte, it was at 19.6%. So he's like shown that he can make a basic read on a drive or a willingness to do so. And again, you think about that Charlotte team, very up tempo. LaMelo, when he's on the floor, leading the charge there. And, you have those cracks because they're playing as fast as they are, up and down style. He can make basic reads from there. So to that point, like, we've seen him do it. But even circling back to like the last 10 games or last 11 games for him, passing on 25% of drives over his last 11 games. A very big number, higher than his overall season number, more than double or roughly double of what it was last year in Charlotte. So to your point, like, it is perking up more. And if you can maintain, if he finds a greater balance there and they get healthy, then that should bode well. And if Kelly Oubre in general can make good decisions and compete on defense, he's an athletic wing that can shoot and drive. Like, there are just going to be minutes for him on a competent team. And so I think he's well on his way. Like, I was someone that was, going back to the beginning of the year or the offseason, I had questions about the Oubre fit in Philly. I didn't know if they're going to play fast enough. I more so envision, second units headlined by Tyrese Maxey and everyone else. He can run with those group, feel good. I didn't know what it was going to look like with him playing alongside Embiid and playing with the starters. Like, he's exceeded my expectations, especially pre like injury / accident. And so if he can slide in to that degree, like, the stock for him should be up heading into the offseason. And we got two more. We have one from Mike Breen, who also noted in the email, not that Mike Breen. So take a little bit of luster off, I suppose. Bang! Send! Okay. But there's all this discourse on how to fix the All-Star game, but have we taken a step back to ask the question if we even need the All-Star game? The original intent of the game way back in the day was to showcase the game's stars, but do we even need this game to accomplish that? I'd venture to say that the last decade and a half of All-Star games, save one or two, have had a negative effect. We live in a much different time with 24-hour social media-driven news cycles, those, etc., where these stars are promoted and talked about nonstop. And then I will just quickly add, we also have League Pass. So in theory, we can't just see the stars whenever. But back to the question, I think we should still have the All-Star vote and the honor given to the players, but just get rid of the game. Have a weekend centered around the parties. That's all the players want to really do anyhow. Fans just want to rub shoulders with players and celebrities too. The only exciting part of the weekend is the three-point contest, so build on that. Expand to a 32-player pool with NBA and WNBA contestants, two shooters going at a time for the first two rounds. The dunk contest is dead, so we should let that go as well. Static stage dunks just don't have the juice of dynamic in-game dunks, i.e. Jaylen Brown, and it's impossible to recreate that magic, so why force it? Instead of trying to fix the All-Star game with small tweaks every year, Silver needs to reframe the problem that the All-Star game is trying to solve to come up with a better solution. Love the show. Thank you for all the hard work that goes into these shows. I bet we like an iceberg and we only see a tiny bit of what it takes to bring us these shows. So, after we last week riffed about 15 minutes on All-Star game selections or All-Star game tweaks, Mike was like, hey, how about we just don't have the game actually? That's a good bit. That's the duality of the dunkers. You know?
Great question, Mike. I don't want to pour too much water on it, but I have some thoughts. Number one, I think the point about more stars being available now is a good one. Just as someone who was born in a different era, that was a time to see people play together and see some people you just hadn't been available to see a bunch of. And so there was a neat aspect to that, to where everyone kind of came together. It was like this super event that kind of lost a little bit of that luster. I don't know if you're going to get rid of the All-Star game. Number one, like, the economic impact on the cities that host the weekend is fairly significant. And, you know, part of the TV package, All-Star game, just kind of goes hand in hand. I think that it's the game, you just kind of have to change your perspective on it. I think at some point we will get another competitive one. I think just the play style is just so different. It's just going to feel different. Now, to the 32-player pool, how are you convincing these people to come on their vacation
money
for a mega three-point contest?
That's about it. Like, I don't, yeah. It wasn't my idea.
Hey, buddy. Buddy, I watch. I'm in Cancun.
my star is on the boat.
To the dunk contest point, it's for the kids, man. For the kids. That's all I got.
Oh, okay. Like, to Steve's point, especially on the financial portion of it, like, I do not think we're going to get the game outright removed. Though I will say it was interesting. What was it, earlier this week, Adam Silver was talking about, hey, we got to think about maybe we don't need this. So, like, you know, to the broader context of the question, like, Mike, you don't appear to be far off from the commissioner. As much as I complain about the game every year, like, I don't want the game to go altogether. Like, I'm still very much into, let's tweak it a little bit. But, you know, to Steve's point again, let's get some actual competitors in it. They can kind of restore the feeling to that degree. Like, I still rather press that button and try to figure it out versus getting rid of it altogether. And because, like, even, you know, going down that rabbit hole, like, I wonder how I feel about, you know, as I complained about All-Star voting and legacy stuff and all this stuff. Like, if there's just no game and it's just here's the vote and here are the guys that selected, like, does that feel different? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question. Does it, if there's not going to be a game because the game is bad and it's just vote slash, you know, media vote, player vote, whatever, does that add to, like, the Hall of Fame mystique of it all if you are 9-time All-Star? I would imagine it feels more like a merit thing than anything if there's not a game attached to it. And so, like, how that shifts how we think about it and how it's voted for and all that good stuff. Like, if the fans know they're not getting they're not going to get to see insert player here in the All-Star game do dunks or shoot deep threes, will fans then approach it as, well, this guy's an All-Star because I think he deserves it? Like, it is a general fan vote, so there will still be a major element of, I like this guy, here's my vote. But I wonder if we see, like, a small shift there if there's no game attached. So I guess that would be interesting, but, like, ultimately, I don't want the game to go away. I just want it to be better. To the three-point pool, like, 32 seems high. But I do like the idea of, again, you get the W and the NBA involved to a higher degree, and you have two shooters going at the same time on either end of the court. Like, I do think there's room to expand it and do it like that. You get the split screen on television. Like, I wonder what the live experience for that would be, honestly. I think TV is very easy to see. You just, you know, split screen like it's a Zoom call or something like that. You see both shooters going at the same time, you count the score, whatever. If I'm live in arena, that might feel like a bit much to follow. But even then, like, you know, in the question, it's for the first two rounds. Like, if you can get past that, or if it's just easier to keep track of than I'm giving credit for, then it might not be a big deal. So I'm not super anti expand the field and do it like that. I don't know if 32 is the number. Do you want to, like, because we have, what is it, 8 participants right now? Like, if we get that to 16 or maybe 20 to start. Like, I wonder if you get it to 20, do you have, like, a first round bye for, like, whoever won the W contest, whoever won the NBA contest the following year? You get 18 in the first round, something like that. Like, I think there are ways to do it and expand it. I just don't know if 32 is the number.
That's a lot of shots.
It is. It is. I'm just thinking through it. Like, what does it look like? But I mean, I guess the expanded field would be because, well, we don't have the dunk contest anymore. So we got to fill this TV slot. So I guess within that context, that's why the number is so big. So sure. I guess if we're going to remove the dunk contest, which I'm not even a super proponent of that right now, like I may feel differently next year, but like I'm not at remove the dunk contest either. And if you do that, again, bring back the shooting stars competition. Bring that back, replace it with, I don't know if I want to replace that with horse. Honestly, maybe that's the bit. Maybe just turn the dunk contest into a horse competition. It's just horse with dunks. Here's this 360 between the legs. Now you have to do it. Here's this toss offside of backboard into a windmill. Now you have to do it. Like, maybe that's how you get the stakes. You get the dunks at the same time, but it doesn't feel, you know what I mean? What's up?
Nikias, do I need to reintroduce you to the wheel of dunks?
Well, like, no, because like that, you know, at least there's a bigger element of choice to that. But like the person that goes first anyway. Versus, we don't need the wheel of dunks. Dunker with small hands spills. Oh no, it's Julius Erving. I don't want that. So like, at least with the horse option, you get more of an element of choice. Though you do still kind of blend itself into, like, if Dunker 1 has bigger hands and can palm it and do all this stuff, and Dunker 2 has to follow it up, like, that stinks. But at least Dunker 1 can choose. As opposed to everybody doing the wheel, you know?
If I was 6'10", wouldn't I just do all the big dunks, big man dunks?
I mean, it's a dunk contest. Still got it, you know?
Just tall dude just standing doing a right off vert.
It's like, hey.
Yeah, you can't jump like that. Oh, no, man.
Get your bunnies up.
Get your bunnies? Okay. All right. Do we have another question?
Hey, oh, I'm my just gosh. Saying it. All right, last one is going to come from Matt, not one of the 14 Matts that we have in the Dunker Spot watch party somehow. But Matt says, I saw this on TikTok and wanted to ask you two, who's the worst NBA and WNBA player that could take a 16 seed to a NCAA title?
I want to reframe the question, though. I don't want to say the worst.
Okay.
I mean, that's a negative connotation. I don't want to do that. It's disrespectful. Mm-hmm. I Cam Thomas down.
Okay.
I feel like the archetype for the men's side would have to be someone who just gets on a heater and continues to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Women's side gets interesting. Number 16 seeds are 1 in 116. Shout out to Harvard.
Jeez.
I still don't know how they beat Stanford. I was like 11 years old. I'm like, what's happening? thought about trying to cheat on this one. Mm. Not going to lie. Like, Gonzaga made a run as an 11 seed. So I was going to be like Courtney Vandersloot.
I see. I was like, how would you even cheat in this conversation? But, oh, okay.
And then Oregon had that run as a 10 seed. So I was just going to pick Sabrina.
Hey, who's better right now? Here's the trick. Vandersloot or Sabrina? that may, you know, inform your answer.
even though I'm going Hanzu.
Hmm.
But here's the problem. Like, this is going to end up being like a triple team. She's going to get him up anyways. No, I'm going Han. Yeah, Han's my pick.
So would Han be Edie? I was trying to figure out the... Okay, but anyway, you're going with Han on the W side. You got Cam Thomas on the NBA side, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is boring because like Cam was also the first person that I thought about on the men's side. Super score will get on heater. And I was just trying to think, like, is there like a post-up big that doesn't really work? But like in the tournament could just blast folks. And so like, he's not just this archetype. But I was like, what would a Bobby Portis led college team look like?
Oh, I like that.
It's like, you know, that's
interesting.
It's like that gets interesting. But at that point, like, then that went to, hey, is Bobby better than Cam? And I was like, well, they're super different. But like, yeah, so that was the whole thing. Like, what does a Spencer Dinwiddie run look like? Like, in theory, you get the pull-ups and the drives. And, like, you know, it's college. So, like, the playmaking, you know, C-plus playmaking in the NBA is probably, like, B-plus in college. So, like, could you get enough? So, I don't know. I guess then the W side just gets tough.
Who you got?
I said, huh? Like, the first person I thought about was, like, Megan Gustafson. And I was just like, you know, like, that was just funny to think about. Like, you know, hey, she's going to be like, what, third or fourth big in Vegas? And she averaged 28-13 in her final year at Iowa. Like, that's the threshold. To get, only 144 spots, which, you know, based on the cap and all that good stuff, it's really like 131 spots. And it's like, dang, there are a whole lot of, like, dominant college players that just don't make rosters in the W. So it's just like, hot. What you do with that? Like, Sabrina's a good call, but like, I feel like I was trying to think like sub all-star division. And so like, it had to be like sub all-star division, but scorer. Got like AD Durr, Dana Evans. I'm trying to think of like scoring guards or pull-up guards.
Is it just Maddie Segrist?
But even then, like, Maddie wanted to, but yeah, I don't, That's the other thing that happened for a headlock. Like, do we need to pick like an actual champion? Because, like, if, you know, if worst, quote unquote, worst WNBA player was, you know, generally a star in college, but like didn't have like a Final Four run under their belt, kind of hard to say they're gonna lead a 16 seed. See, it's just me doing the Nikias thing. So I don't, you know. My fault.
Golly. Just pick Kirsten Bell. Goodness.
I'll think about this more post-pod. Steve's going to yell at me for thinking about this too much. All right. Any closing thoughts or any free throws before we get out of here?
Do you have free throws?
I do not.
This man. Oh, my goodness. If Kelly Oubre said that to you, what are you doing?
I'm disagreeing and walking away.
Dennis Schroeder said Cam Thomas is a max player. Thoughts?
Can he be a consistent starting player first before we get to?
Stronger, most improved player case. Delano Bannon or Miles McBride?
That is very Nikias peeled. Wow. that's good stuff. Wow. Because honestly, they both kind of fit into the opportunity bowl. Like, it's probably Delano for me. Just because not only is he getting just a whole bunch more usage, like, he's hitting jumpers, which was kind of the big thing that kept them from being consistent NBA piece, or at least led to more questions. So, like, if that proves to be true, like, it's probably Delano in the truest sense. Shout out to the dudes, though. That man is hooping. And doing a lot of it as he's playing over 40 minutes consistently. So hope he keeps it up.
Jalen Green or Cade Cunningham?
It's Cade for me, but Jalen looks darn good right now. Another big game. Houston's won 10 in a row, Steve. I think the stat was them and Boston are the only two teams that have had a 10-plus game winning streak this year.
It's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Shout out Ime Udoka. You know, I ain't had to deal with the pain from the last 3 years, but they hyped.
I don't know how y'all live like this, but I'm glad we can talk.
D'Angelo Russell or Jordan Clarkson?
Just who's had the better year? Or
sure.
Probably D'Lo for me.
Really?
No disrespect to Jordan Clarkson.
End it.
Okay. Well, fair enough. All right. Well, I guess we will cap it there. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Also, every Tuesday, we are on JJ Reddit's YouTube channel if you enjoy the visual elements. So if you haven't subscribed to JJ Reddit's YouTube channel already, please do so. Check us out. Get some clips spliced into the videos as we're talking about all the hoop stuff. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community. We're having fun discussions in there. Lots of jokes being tossed in there as well. But if you have a League Pass subscription and you want to watch basketball with us or in general hang out with us, because we just bounce all over the place conversation-wise, join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties via Watch Playback. It is free to create an account. All you need, again, is a League Pass subscription so you can see the games on screen. But you get to watch those with us. Getting real-time analysis, top-tier vibes. We're breaking down some stuff during commercial breaks, especially when we have like our focus games. If we do have fourth quarter or overtime antics, we're breaking down what went right or wrong with the last-second play. So if you enjoy that type of thing, or if you just want a place to, you know, vent about work stuff or like stuff or ask for relationship advice, which that became a whole thing yesterday, so that was fun, come rock with us. It's hyperlinked in the podcast description, so just click on that. It is, once again, free to create your account. You just need a League Pass account. To link to your profile into the room so you can hop in and watch with us. Do that, have some fun, come enjoy some hoops with us. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Good job, Nikias. Did you see Isaiah Hartenstein call himself Brightskin?